Yes, now all I have to do is push the little button. And there we are. We went through the current laws on Tuesday. And again, you know, I have to apologize for my immodesty here by giving my own name to a law, right? It's that's why I put it in brackets. But my point here is a very salient one, I hope. And it underlines a lot of the current friction, a lot of the current problems we have in particularly IT and business, but IT and government, etc. That is that the engineers through the 90s and to this day have done a fabulous job in developing new technologies. But in fact, what do the computer scientists and the computer engineers and those kinds of people worry about? They worry about what goes on behind the screen. And they did a very brilliant job figuring out how to make things work behind the screen. It fell into the lap for us as organizations, managers, etc., to figure out how to make that stuff work in our business environments, in our organization environments. That wasn't the job of computer scientists. And in fact, we have been doing a very lousy job of it. Again, case in point, when it comes to archiving the emails of the federal government, we don't have that figured out, or we have it figured out in a pretty poor kind of way. Secondly, habit, within an organization, habit is actually a very good thing. Habit and routine mean, by default, if the habits and routines are done right, it means that things get done properly, right? If you have a habit when you're getting ready to make a left turn, just to have your hand sweep over and hit the blinker, you don't have to think about it. You're doing the right thing by habit. So routine and habit is a very good thing for maintaining organizational coherence. At the same time, it's also a profound barrier to innovation. And what we find time and time again is that quite often new information technologies get dropped into working environments, whether they're offices or factories, and it's left to the people there to make them work. And oftentimes they have very, very deep resistance to it. And the project I was doing this summer, a virtual museum project up on the Bay Mills Reservation, I really wanted the Bay Mills History Department, you know, who was very good at what they were doing. They had very sort of uneven digital handling practices. I came in there with a great solution. I said, hey, look, you know, we've got this database-driven stuff. You can do all of your stuff in here. It's really easy. I showed them the interface, and their sense was, well, it's been working fine now. Why should we change? That fact of inertia is something, indeed, that we'll talk about all the way through the course, because, in fact, if we look at the IT itself, we can be very starry-eyed about the possibilities of progress. If we look at the organizational structures and practices, we have to have serious second thoughts as to how we can do that. So now let me get to the meat and potatoes. For vegetarians, I guess that's not a good one. But let's get to the real hard stuff here. Could you and Jason hand these out? These are Jason. Did Jason disappear? Well, when he comes back, or if somebody wants to volunteer, good. Thanks. I'll make sure nobody steals your box. So let's get our roll up our sleeves, as it were, and talk about the basics of computing. The first distinction that's made in the IT world is between hardware and software. Hardware is the stuff that you see. Software is the stuff that you don't see. Woo! Boy, was that easy. Now, let's get a little more complicated. Hardware includes things like processing units, computers themselves, memory, hard drives, printers, monitors, phone ringers, other kinds of stuff. But there's no brains to it. A computer has to have a set of instructions for the hard drive to talk to the memory, to talk to the processor, etc. This is what software does. The core piece of software in any computing system is, of course, the operating system. I'm sure in this room, roughly half of the people use a Windows operating system. The other people use Mac OS X, the two most common operating systems. Do we have any Linux users here? Good, good. Thank you. I'll talk some about Linux, which is a very cool system, free, very nice, very elegant. We'll talk a lot about open source, but that comes later. So the core piece of software in any computing system is the operating system. It tells the hardware how to talk with each other, how to coordinate everything that goes on. It also includes applications, things like Microsoft Word, Photoshop, etc. It also includes communications so that computers can talk with each other. It also includes communications so that applications can talk with each other. You ever notice how many of us have used Adobe products? Photoshop, Illustrator. You ever notice how you can do one thing in one Adobe application and you kind of think, well, I could do this in this other application too, but they don't talk to each other. So you can generate something in Illustrator, which I love working in, and it's like I could do this in Photoshop, but Photoshop can't quite do it, and Photoshop isn't aware of what I'm doing in Illustrator. Good software has what's called IAC, inter-application communication, so that when you change something in one application, the other application is aware of it. And indeed, what I want to argue is that this whole notion of, number one, a separation between operating systems and applications is not a necessary division. And secondly, a world full of applications, you know, I look at my hard drive from time to time and I do an inventory and I find out that I have 500 applications on this. Every time I sit down and I want to do something, I have to think, okay, task, what application do I need? We go through this cognitive hurdle every time we want to get work done because we've separated so much of what we do by applications. Now, the machine talks to itself or has its internal commands processed not in English, not in any language we know, but in something called machine language, a stream of bits and bytes, ones and zeros. Now, if you're writing software, if you were writing software 60 years ago, you would actually write the ones and the zeros. You would write the machine code. There is no human being alive who can write complicated applications or software in machine code. Instead, what they do is they write in a programming language. A programming language, I think of a programming language as being sort of equivalent to music, right? You can read music, and music makes a lot of sense if you know how to read the language, and you go, okay, it changes an octave here, changes a key here, right? It's a kind of specialized coded language that works as a very efficient shorthand for representing music. Similarly, programming languages are quite readable by people who can read code. Just as a trained musician can read a musical score and have it go on in her head and actually understand what it sounds like. We have to remember, of course, Beethoven wrote the Ninth Symphony when he was deaf, so he could sit there and just write the code and know what it sounded like. Similarly, a good programmer can look at the code and understand what's going on, what the functions are, what the whole processes are associated with that. So code, source code, programming code in languages like C, C++, Objective-C, what are some of the other favorites? Java, Perl, Python, PHP, all kinds of different languages to do different things. But if you're writing applications, you're generally using some part of the C family. Objective-C, C++, C#, etc. But a programmer can read that, but the machine doesn't execute the source code. The machine executes, again, machine code. So you have to have an application that takes that source code and translates it into machine code. This is called a compiler. So a compiler takes that source code and turns it into the bits and bytes that the machine can process. Now, Source code is the number one most valuable asset for a software company. If, for example, well, let's put it this way. The source code for Microsoft is the equivalent to the formula for Coca-Cola, to the Coca-Cola Corporation. They keep that stuff locked down tight. Because anybody who can get access to the Microsoft source code can indeed develop their own Microsoft products, develop clones of Microsoft products, and indeed basically undercut everything Microsoft does. And instead of charging, I don't know, what do you pay, $60 for Office around here if you're a student? You could do it for free if you had the source code, as the open source community does. I should mention, what is, in passing, what is the open source community? The open source community is made up of a bunch of people who write programs, do a lot of programming, and instead of doing what Microsoft does and what Apple does it even as snarly as Microsoft does, they keep that source code locked down tight. What it means, of course, is that only their people can read their code, and only their people can debug the code, and only their people can figure out what might be wrong with the code. The open source community, by contrast, says all of the code we write is public, it can be seen, it can be examined, etc. Let me just mention, since I'm on, this is somewhat tangential at this point, but while we're on the issue of open source, you might say, well, okay, if indeed all of the source code is public, then any hacker in the world can read it. And it's more vulnerable, right? If you think, for example, Microsoft products, Microsoft networking stuff, such as it is, Microsoft networking stuff, you can well imagine if you're the federal government, if you're the Department of the Ministry of Homeland Security or the Ministry of War, and you have Microsoft code, you want to make sure that that stuff is secure, that nobody can hack in and, shall we say, launch missiles at the Soviet Union's gone, but we still have missiles pointed at Russia. We're not quite sure why. But one could launch missiles at Russia by hacking that code. So a lot of people say, well, okay, if we do secure work with open source code, then any hacker can hack the code, and open source code would hence be inherently less secure. Actually, it turns out to be the opposite. And this is counterinstinctual. Open source code means that if there's a bug, anybody in the world can look at that and find the bug, talk about the bug, and publish the bug. And it can be fixed. What you'll see if you follow the discussion list, the boards, the forums, etc., for the open source community, somebody will say, oh no, there's a bug in the DNS addressing code for the networking in Linux. That'll get announced within 24 hours. There's a patch for it. What happens when a bug is found in an Apple product or a Microsoft product? We, the consumers, will stumble upon it, and we go, it doesn't work, or it's insecure, or somebody just hacked my machine, and what do? Microsoft, Apple, please fix this. And they'll fix it when they get around to it. Worse still, if they have a bug in their source code, they have a very strong business incentive not to tell people about it. Number one, if they tell people that there's a bug in the code, then all the hackers will know that there's a bug and there's a vulnerability, and they'll exploit it. But number two, if Apple and Microsoft announce publicly each day the bugs in their code, the public would begin to say, you guys got a lot of buggy code. This is bad PR.
But if they know the bug is there, why don't they just fix it before they publish it?
Because the question was, why don't they fix it before they publish it? It's often said, and this is snarky, so take it with a grain of salt, that what do you call a Microsoft user? Is a beta tester. That is testing software that's really not quite ready for prime time. In fact, with the complexity of modern software, you've got multiple threads, multiple operations going on at once. These are, in fact, complex systems by the strict definition of it. So things can happen over here that have unexpected effects over here, and it is basically impossible to predict all of the possible bugs that are going to happen, all of the potential bugs. So inherently, software gets put out on the market, and it has bugs. It's unavoidable for it to have bugs. The question is, how fast is the turnaround on the bug fixes? Have we gotten Service Pack 1 yet on Vista?
Yeah.
How many months did that take after the release?
Not very long. It was quick.
Oh, okay. So, right, because bug fix or Service Pack 1 happens 3 months after it hits market and everybody's realized, my God, my printers don't work or all of this stuff, and they, you know, go crazy and fix the most obvious bugs, then you have to wait for Service Pack 2. Has that come out yet on Vista? Yeah? Has it? No? It'll come out soon, but, you know, it's not trivial to recompile everything after the bugs are fixed and get the patches out there, etc. Very complicated stuff. In any case, to get back to the thread here, we make traditionally a distinction between hardware and software. How many of you remember the days of Nintendo game cartridges? Remember those little suckers? I think that's a pretty cool approach to distributing software. Because a game cartridge is essentially a read-only memory, a ROM. It has software etched in silicon. Frankly, it's a pretty cool approach. It can't be hacked. It's pretty secure. I've always wanted, you know, I don't know why nobody's done this, and maybe somebody with a CE background or a CS background can help me out here. I think it'd be really cool just to release operating systems on little thumb drive guys. You know, read-only thumb drives. You want to boot your machine, you plug it in, hit the on button, and there you are. You want an update, they ship you a new little thumb drive with your operating system on it. It would be secure, it would be unhackable, etc. Who knows why? My point here, though, is that read-only memory, a lot of which we see in things like iPhones, smartphones, etc., iPods, have actually software etched in silicon. So let's get confusing here. You've got a version of this on the handout we gave you. The version you got handed out is in your hand is better than this one. The basic principle I want to get across here for starters is the notion of layers. And one can use that notion of layering to understand how a computer basically works. Let me go through this in order. You fire up your machine. Your machine is just sitting there dead, right? Assuming it doesn't have flash memory in it. It's sitting there dead, nothing's going on. You hit the on button, what happens? It wakes up. And it has to have something that says, well, what do I do now? And it's got this little thing called the basic input-output system, the BIOS. Just a tiny little bit of code etched in silicon that says, okay, wake up, hit the snooze button. Or wake up and look to the hard drive. And the hard drive is over there. That's the address. That's what you do. It has a very small number of routines etched in silicon that basically say, this is what you do to get started. Interesting story here that gets into the business side of this already. The IBM PC, which is now called the Wintel box, that, you know, what is it, 90% of the population uses running Windows on Intel, that basic box came out in September of 1981. I remember when it came out. Now, IBM was a huge corporation that frankly didn't like the idea of personal computers. Their business was all in these massive mainframes that would fill this room. University of Michigan had, I don't know, probably a couple dozen of these massive, massive mainframe computers. And IBM looked at personal computers as, frankly, a dangerous threat to their market. So they figured, from business strategic reasons, okay, we need to get into this market so we can basically control which direction it goes so it doesn't undercut our mainframe market. Again, we're back in the early 80s. But IBM has always worked, or up until roughly the mid-90s, had always worked from a basic monopolistic view of the world. We own this platform. We control everything. We control the hardware. We control the software. We have the guys in the white coats. We have the whole army of people. We lease the machines. Most people don't own it. A very closed business model. And they figured, okay, we don't want to invent these personal computers. We don't want to put them out on the market and have competition. So what we'll do is we will patent our BIOS. We will patent this tiny little chip with a tiny little bit of code so that anybody who tries to produce a personal computer to compete with us will be violating our patent. You follow me here? It was their way to use a patent to dominate the personal computer industry. Not only, and I love this, it's a very nice intellectual property story. Not only did they patent it, they published it in a number of engineering journals. Why did they do this? Lauren knows this from our conversation yesterday talking about prior art. By publishing it, it was in a journal so that anybody who came up with their own version of a BIOS pretty much had to prove that they didn't steal it from IBM. You follow the logic here? So the weight of responsibility was on the innovator to prove that they were not infringing IBM. So there was a company called Compaq that came along about 6 months later and said, well, we really want to enter the PC market to compete with these IBM PCs. I should mention, well, I'll mention this in a minute. We want to come up with our version. And indeed, IBM PCs literally had the first versions, had no hard drives, they had tiny little floppies on them, and they cost a bloody arm and a leg. Viciously expensive. And there was a huge profit markup for IBM on it, right? Because they used that BIOS as a way to protect a high price margins on them. Okay, so Compaq hired several engineers, put them in a white room with video cameras on them, and said, okay, come up with your own BIOS. These engineers sat down under the video cameras and did it, came up with a BIOS, and came up with what was called the PC clone under the Compaq label. These emerged by about late 82, I believe. Compaq showed up, undercut IBM's price by at least 50% on equivalent units. What do you think IBM did? They sued. When in doubt, remember, this is the new model for American business. When you're in jeopardy, sue. Don't compete, sue. Bring in the lawyers. So they immediately took Compaq to court. They said, you violated our BIOS patent. The Compaq people brought out their old VHS tapes, remember VHS tapes, stuck them in the machine in front of the judge and said, look, we did this on our own. The judge said, you did this on your own. Basically gave Compaq a green light, said you can go ahead and do that. And as a consequence, the monopoly that IBM wanted to have on personal computers disappeared thanks to Compaq. They figured that they'd have the choke point. Now, a consequence of that, an interesting spin-off consequence, is it began what we call the commodity computer industry. That is, on the PC side, as we called it, do we still call it the PC side, PCs and Mac? Yeah, we do. I've seen the ads, right? Okay, on the PC side, IBM had built their PC basically by getting parts from everybody else, making their own box and putting a label on it. Right? They didn't manufacture their own computers. They outsourced 99% of it and just put a nameplate on somebody else's box. What this meant then is that the industry got built around a component model. That from the very get-go on the PC side, one could buy a motherboard, which is a basic thing that everything plugs into. One could buy a hard drive, memory, CPU, put them all in a box and have a computer. I did that. I have a server at home that I actually run OS X on illegally. What I'm doing is an experimental research, so I guess it's okay. But I have a hacked version of OS X running on a box that I made from parts. Runs very well. I use it as a server. That model meant that downstream, as a consequence, there were tremendous price pressures. This is why PCs got so cheap. Because basically anybody who could buy parts and put them into a box could sell a PC. Very, very competitive, and it's the reason why today we have actually so very few players in the industry. Dell dominates the PC industry because they figured out the best way, the cheapest way, to assemble the cheapest parts and turn out these computers. They took over, they have about a 30% market share now, simply because they have incredibly good manufacturing techniques to assemble the cheapest parts available. Believe me, if you have a Dell, you're familiar with this problem. In any case, moving along, so we turn the machine on, and I'll get to this other business side stuff throughout. I'll carry it on as a thread. You fire up the machine, it wakes up, the hard drive starts spinning, it starts stuffing stuff over into memory, and it says, okay, gotta load the operating system. This is what happens when your system boots. You're waiting there, the little hourglass guy is doing this, or, you know, it's just kind of sitting there. It's loading the operating system. The operating system, again, makes it possible for everything to talk to everything else, everything to recognize everything else, and indeed, it has to be able to talk to things. It has to be able to talk to your monitor, talk to your keyboard, talk to your mouse, etc. So it has to have a whole layer of device drivers so that the operating system says, oh, I see a Canon 850 inkjet printer out there. I need to talk to it, so it loads the little bit of code that it needs to communicate between the operating system and the hardware. It does this routinely now, all invisibly. Believe me, it didn't used to. It was a real pain in the ass before. So your machine is busy there booting up. This is the interesting layer, and I call it legacy. A basic architectural problem here. When the IBM PC was invented in 1981, when the Apple Macintosh came out in 84, or its predecessor, the Apple I and II came out in the late 70s, they were standalone machines. They didn't talk with each other. If you wanted to move files, I remember this. If you wanted to move a file from one machine to the other, you had what was called the sneaker net. That is, you write it to a floppy disk, and those disks actually flopped. They were not hard. They were little floppy disks. You just take it and run it down the hall and stick it in another machine. That was called networking, the sneaker network, right? Because in the early stages of the computer industry, there was very little thought about computers talking with each other. At most, with the IBM PC, it was set up so it could talk to IBM mainframes, but not much else. Indeed, IBM considered their PCs to be little more, in the first stages, as little more than dumb terminals. That is, windows into the mainframe that have a little bit of intelligence of their own, but not very much. This meant that in the basic architecture of both the Macintosh, the early Macintosh, and of the IBM PC, networking had to be sort of stuffed in there. It wasn't conceived as existing in the operating system itself. It had to be sort of loaded after. I remember back in the late 80s configuring a bunch of machines for my colleagues. I had a line of 8 486 machines, Intel machines, sitting there. And I'd load the operating system, and then I had to go through all of these stunts to get the packetizer and the communications going. Why? Because it was not in there architecturally. By contrast, and this is one thing that makes Linux and the Unix family of operating systems so much more secure, is that The communications was built into the operating system from the get-go. This is a critical distinction. It made Unix machines to this day, and Mac OS is the operating system is a derivative of Unix. FreeBSD, I believe it is, adapted for Mac. When communications is architected in the very basis of the operating system, then communications becomes rather trivial. Talking to the internet for a Unix architecture is little different from talking to a hard drive or talking to the memory. It's architected in. Why? Because Unix itself was invented in 1969 by Bell Labs, the old phone company research arm, to run the switching systems for long-distance phone calls. In other words, the operating system had communications in there. This is why we still, up until about 10 years ago, still had problems with both the Mac and the PC with communications getting hacked, because the security considerations at this layer are never as powerful as the security considerations here. You can prevent things at this level that you can't prevent at that level. Now, this is all sort of water over the dam, under the bridge, whatever it is. Sorry. I don't know how to use my phone, so that's what I do. I don't even know how to turn the sucker on and off or put it on rest. In any case, you know, I might know tech, but I don't know phones. That's your generation. In any case, legacy issue that we're still paying for somewhat. At this point, with Mac OS X and with every Windows operating system, help me out here, since Vista? No, since XT, communications have been integrated. Now, the next layer is the most problematic. It's the APIs, the Application Programmer Interface. Fancy term, fancy acronym. What do we mean by API? Essentially, if you have an operating system, oh, it's a phone I need, it's a call I need to take anyway. It's my Indian friends up north. In any case, I'm sorry, I lost the thread. The APIs are a set of protocols that an application programmer has to use to talk to the operating system. Let me make this clear, because it's a very complicated notion. An operating system has a lot of capabilities, right? The application sits on top of it and says, okay, send a character to a screen, or do this to the screen, do this to the printer, store this, store that. It has to be able to talk to the operating system, you know, between the two layers. Now, every operating system is different with respect to the APIs, and the APIs are very, very detailed in their parameters. If you want to make your software work right as an applications programmer, you've got to know those APIs. You've got to know them very, very well. Now, this is only necessary if you have a basic model of the industry in which you have a distinction between applications and operating systems. You go back to the days of the IBM mainframes, 50s, 60s, and 70s, there was not a distinction. As far as IBM was concerned, operating system, schmoperating system. You know, we can mash them all together because it was all in-house. They didn't need to articulate these layers. But in the PC industry, the personal computing industry, we did. Why am I making so much noise about this? Because, in fact, the monopoly that IBM tried to create around the BIOS, Microsoft created with its APIs. How did they do that? If you own the operating system, if you're writing the APIs, you can control what applications work on your system. It took Microsoft a few years to figure this out. If you look at the personal computing industry in 1988, 89, the major word processing package was WordPerfect. The major spreadsheet was Lotus 1-2-3. The major database was Ashton Tate. The major presentation thing, I don't even remember what it was called, it's gone now. In other words, Microsoft in 1987 had the lion's share of the operating system market, but frankly, Office had virtually zero footprint. Ironically, Office or Microsoft Word was developed not for the PC, but for the Macintosh initially. I know it's kind of odd. But Microsoft understood something very brilliant and very nefarious at that moment. As they were developing Windows, Windows was their first version to get away from a command line where all you saw were characters on the screen, no mouse interface, no graphical user interface. As they transitioned to an interface largely to try and copy the Macintosh interface, they decided to come up with a new set of APIs. Companies like Lotus 1-2-3, like Ashton Tate, like WordPerfect, knocked on the door at Redmond, Washington, said, hey, you guys are developing a new operating system. Can we get the APIs so we can rewrite WordPerfect to run on it? Guess what Microsoft said? Sorry, they're still in development. We can't give you these APIs. As a consequence, 6 months after the introduction of Windows, technically speaking, Windows 3.1, after the introduction of Windows 3, you couldn't run WordPerfect on it. You couldn't run Lotus on it. You couldn't run DBase 3 on it. In other words, what Microsoft understood was that if you control the APIs, you control everything above it. By controlling the APIs, they basically leveraged their monopoly, their near monopoly in operating systems, to turn it into a monopoly in Office applications. This is how Microsoft Office got dominant. Again, because the APIs are the crucial choke point in the operating of a typical computer. Any questions on that? Because I know it's fairly complicated. Okay, moving along. Okay, the next layer is fairly simple. Applications, we know these, our email, our browsers, all of our other stuff, Kazaa, BitTorrent, the stuff we use to share music and do other illegal activities, which I'm sure nobody in this room would ever do. Good, law-abiding citizens that we all are. Yeah. Pretty straightforward. Until we start thinking of a browser as something more than a window onto the internet. A browser can be more than that. A browser can have within it an executable, that is, that it can actually do something. It can have an application delivered through the browser. This is what Java does a lot of, the Java programming language. This is what so-called Web 2.0 is based around. That is, browsers that are something more than just dumb viewers that actually can interact and take user input and get output going on, processed elsewhere, etc. In other words, the browser itself, with the emergence of the web, begins to look an awful lot like, or can potentially look an awful lot like, the basic desktop, right? You fire up your machine, you're ready to go, you see the desktop. That's the old model. When browsers started emerging in 1990, if I recall, 89, when browsers started emerging, Microsoft looked at it and said, this could displace our whole operating system. Because somebody could come up with a browser that becomes a dashboard to the entire machine, the control interface for the entire machine. Yes?
Google's not doing that. They came out with their own browser.
Precisely. A lot of people are saying, Google is the next Microsoft. We'll get into this a little more. Very good point. Because indeed the browser can act as an interface to applications, just like we thought the desktop did and still does. For that reason, Microsoft started what was called the browser wars of the late 80s and early 90s. They got pasted by federal court for antitrust, but the Bush administration came in, and thanks to the fact that Bill Gates' dad is a principal in a Republican lobbying firm, it turned out that that antitrust case largely disappeared when the Bush administration came into office in 2001. My point here, then, is that things begin to get fuzzy as we move toward the more sophisticated application layer. Because those applications can talk to the internet, can have storage activity and processing activity happen elsewhere. This is what we call middleware. Course Tools, perfect example of middleware. You go to Course Tools, you go to Wolverine Access. Some of the processing happens on your machine, some of the processing happens on the server. And indeed, one can begin to imagine a system in which a lot of the processing and storage happens not in your machine, but as we call it today, out in the cloud. This is what Google Docs is. How many people here have used Google Docs? Pretty damn cool, right? Has pretty much all of the capability of Microsoft Word, and it's free. Stores your documents for you, and gosh, they even index it for you. Well, they index it for themselves because they want your information, but we trust Google, right? We'll get to that issue much later. So we begin to see at this layer above applications, and this has emerged very much with Web 2.0, web-based applications, web services, and a whole new framework that we call XML. XML is a whole way, it's called extensible markup language. It's a way of capturing metadata, that's data that describes data, so that systems can talk to each other, they can have conversations that happen amongst themselves, and we don't even have to worry about it. Because XML allows a very, very rich and thick description of a document, of a process, of anything that's going on. It's a standardized language that works very, very well. Microsoft's effort to move into that is called .NET. Is .NET still around? Do they still support that? Yeah, it's really ratty. Nobody much likes it. None of the computer scientists I've ever talked to like it. But Microsoft rolled it out, and you know, by 1995, it used to be said in 1965, if you're an IT person working in a company, you can't go wrong by buying IBM. By 1995, you couldn't go wrong by buying Microsoft. Unfortunately, the university currently seems to be on that binge as well. The next layer, and the reason this brown stuff, this brown part goes all the way here, is we can actually talk about massively networked systems in which processing cycles are shared. Anybody ever heard of SETI? SETI is a wonderful kind of concept. It stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. I know, it sounds like a bad science fiction movie. But essentially, imagine the problem. The radio telescopes pointed out at the sky, and what do they usually pick up? White noise. That's what most of the radio signals out there in the universe are, is just white noise. The theory, however, is that if we have some sort of regular pattern in that white noise, it might betray that there's somebody out there on the other side who actually is putting a pattern out there. And so if there is a regularity in those signals, it is a sign of intelligent life. We're still looking for it in the White House, but we're still looking for it out there. As I know, it's not a good joke. So we're searching for intelligent life. What does this mean? It means that we've got huge quantities of this radio signal stuff that needs to be sorted out. that needs to be run through a computer to see if there's any regularity. So what the SETI project does is it takes these huge amounts of data, and if you sign up and you have a machine that's hooked to the internet, permanent, you know, has a always on connection, if you have any spare cycles, it'll throw some of this radio stuff at you, give you the software to process it, you'll process it, and you will inevitably so far say, well, there's nothing here, and then you'll pass your results back up. This is the crudest level of massively distributed computation. You can get grid systems in which you can have processor sharing across high-speed networks, etc. The new model for supercomputing is massively gridded and massively clustered CPUs. Let me give you a very good example of this. Supercomputers used to be these incredibly, you know, like 2001, they look sort of like the John Hancock building or something, you know, these great big monoliths that do all the big computing. Well, we can get that much computing power not out of huge monolithic machines, but of huge numbers of simple processors that are wired together. A server farm. Google, for example, I don't know how many in their main, anybody know? Somebody told me they had 30,000 in their main facility in Mountain View. They had 30,000 blade servers all working together, all wired together. I can't imagine. Imagine the amount of heat that they put up. There was a proposal, just parenthetically, that Google wants to build floating server farms where they have all of their CPUs wired together to do it. They'll have them floating because seawater is cheap and they can use it to cool. I had a proposal that I sent to Google a few years ago. Obviously, it went nowhere. I said, hey, you want to build a server farm? Go to Minnesota. They got plenty of cold air and they can use the heat. They didn't buy it. I thought it was a cool idea, but, you know, waste heat might be green, you know, green computing. Didn't buy it. But they did buy a facility in the Columbia Basin. Any questions on this? So the way to understand this is work your way up, and things get more complicated and more powerful as you work your way up through those layers of abstraction. Let me move to basic hardware. This is the stuff you put your hands on. This is a very dated chart. You can see the old nicotine-colored, CRT, right? Before flat screens, an old Epson printer. What we're trying to get at here is we've got three different families of devices. We've got devices that are largely read-only devices. A CD, not a burnable CD, but a CD that you get in the mail. You can't write to it, you can only read it. Your keyboard, for the most part, only sends things to the computer. It doesn't send things back. I'll put a little bit of caveat in this. We've gotten smarter in the last decade so that when you have a keyboard and you plug it in, it actually says to the computer, hi, I'm a Keyspan computer, model this number. You got a driver, and it says, sure, and they hook up. They have a very short little conversation. Not very smart, but smart enough for you not to have to say, oh, I just put in a new keyboard. Now I got to find a driver, load the driver. It communicates itself enough to do that. So on the top, we have the read-only devices. On the bottom, we have the write-only devices. That is printers, monitors, etc. Again, nothing much happens other than displaying information, whether printed or on a screen. In the middle is where it gets really interesting. These are input-output devices, read-write devices. Obviously, at the very core of a computer is the central processing unit, that chunk of silicon with its tens of thousands of transistors, its little yes-nos, and its little logic trees. That's where things go on. I put a little CPU on there. This is an old G3 chip with a G4 addition on it that I hacked on. You can tell the age of it. So the CPU does the computation. It does the work. It can write to main memory. That's the memory that you buy in your machine. It's called RAM, read-write memory. I should mention that RAM, traditional RAM, when you turn off your machine, it forgets everything, right? If your machine crashes, sorry, it's all gone. right? This is called volatile memory. That is, it has to have a current on it to keep remembering things. So it's volatile. It can also, your CPU can write to your hard drive, read and write to your hard drive. The brilliance in Unix architecture that everybody else has now adopted is, oh, well, you can read and write to the internet as well. You can read and write through your Ethernet port, just as if it's memory or a hard drive or burnable optical media. Whoops. Does that make any sense? We good on that? Okay, so I think that gives us a basic sense of how all of this hardware stuff works. This has to be, remember, going back to what I was saying about the history of the PC industry, where basically it's an industry based on assembling parts, hard drives, memory, CPU, etc. In order for this stuff to work, and you see this on your handout, you don't see it on the screen, you have to have standards. One of the biggest pains in the asses, I have to say, in the late 90s, I've been using my, Macs since 1985. Believe me, in the late 90s, Apple was an utter disaster. If you wanted to buy more memory, you had to buy Apple memory because it wasn't standard. If you wanted to buy a hard drive, you had to buy a hard drive with a special interface because Apple would only talk with those. You paid easily 30% extra for every bloody piece of hardware. Why? Because Apple refused to be standards compliant. It made it a really oddball, annoying player in the industry. Since that time, they've said, okay, USB, fine. USB is a good standard. They've said IEEE 1394, aka FireWire. FireWire, that's fine. They've said PC 100 and its derivatives. That's fine for memory. We will be standards compliant because in a component model, everything has to be highly standardized or it doesn't work. How many of us have bought an external hard drive or a new hard drive? Probably a bunch of us, right? Pretty easy. We don't have to say, ooh, will this plug fit in here? Now, is this the right parameter? We don't have to do that. We just go to Staples or Newegg or whoever, buy a new hard drive, plug it in. We are done. Because we have standards, and standards, I can't stress enough, are critically important. But before we move on, I have to give you sort of a magical moment in the history of Microsoft. This is a real ad. I actually saw this myself on TV when they introduced Windows. Very strange stuff. Would you trust a product coming from a guy like that? Would you buy a used car from this man, as they used to say about Richard Nixon? I don't think so. I have to say parenthetically that for a while I studied French advertising. And French culture for a very long time figured that if you had to advertise, your product was inherently bad, because a good product should sell itself. Obviously, that's long gone. It never permeated American culture. But I think there's something true to that. If they have to scream that hard to sell the product, you should maybe be a little skeptical of it. Should I go through sending an email? Yeah, why don't we take a moment here? Let me get my little pointer guy here. No, that's a pen. Pointer? Yes. Imagine yourself sending an email. This is a good exercise to see how it works. You've got your keyboard here. You hit your little keys, and your keyboard goes into a little port here, into your hardware addressing, talks to your operating system, or excuse me, talks to your application, doesn't talk to your pointer. You get another pointer, talks to your application that feeds it through your API into your operating system. You hit the send button, it goes through your Ethernet card to the internet, and then the return comes back in the reverse order. In other words, it works. Even an email has to get processed through the hardware layer, the application layer, the API. Doesn't have to work with a BIOS, but it has to go through the hardware addressing layer, has to go through the Ethernet card. I'll explain later, shortly, what an email card is. Any questions on these basics? Now we get to the conceptual stuff. Standards. I've covered most of this in passing, so I won't go too far. I won't repeat too much here. The basic distinction in computing systems are component systems versus turnkey or monolithic. Did any of you remember the old Toaster Macs, the ones with the little tiny screens like this? Really? They're all gone? Those suckers were about this high. They made really nice aquariums. After you took the pieces out, you could put little goldfish in them. But they had tiny little screens like this. I bought one of those in 1985. And I wanted to do some work on it, and I realized, oh, I can't open this box. Apple's approach was, in those days, was you might have bought that computer, but we're not going to let you inside. We're not going to let you hack this thing. We're the experts. We know what's best for you. So you, Joe Consumer, don't even think about opening your own computer. No user serviceable parts inside. Their attitude was very arrogant, and they still, frankly, with the iPod, remain pretty arrogant. Can you open it up? Can you hack your own iPod? For the most part, no. Yeah, I know. I have an iPod Touch that I hacked and I jailbreaked and everything else, but we're not supposed to do that. Their approach is, we know best. Now, the advantage to the monolithic approach that Apple still to a point follows is that they can guarantee that the hardware will work with the software, that their applications will work with their operating system. They control all of the parameters, so they can guarantee that it works. This goes back to a very old model. The old model being, believe it or not, IBM. Apple emerged with the Mac in the mid-80s as the giant killer. I'm sure you've all seen the ads and the woman with a running suit and a hammer. She goes into the corporate board meeting that showed in the 1984 Super Bowl, throws this great big hammer, and the corporate drones are freed from IBM. They don't call it IBM, but it's clear that IBM's the bad guy. Well, in fact, Apple's approach to their own hardware was adopted directly from IBM, adopted directly from Xerox, adopted directly from Kodak. That is, we sell you a closed box, it'll work, don't ask questions, don't open our box, don't hack. The opposite approach came from, by circumstance, again, not by plan, on the PC side. Assembling it from parts, putting it together, took a lot of knowledge, took a lot of standards, but it worked. So you had a closed, on the hardware side, you had a closed box approach versus an open box approach. On the software side, again, as I mentioned earlier in passing, you have a similar open versus closed distinction. On the code side, this means that the code base for Windows, the code base for Apple, we're not allowed to see. You have to be an employee or somebody with a lot of creds and a lot of access rights to do it. By contrast, we have open systems like open source software in which anybody can read the code. How many people here have used OpenOffice? How many people? The word processor. What's your general view of this? I love OpenOffice. It's fantastic. And it's free. Nonetheless, the world still uses, this is Frost's Law again, right? Nonetheless, the world still uses predominantly Microsoft Word. How many people have gone to this to the new version of Word, by the way? You know, from Word, what was it called? Word 97 to Vista Word. How many of you done? Is that not weird? You like it? It's a new learning curve, though, right? This is, you know, we'll talk about this when we get to interfaces, but I find it terribly annoying. I don't use Windows products very much, but they change the interface, and it's like, oh, I'm going to spend the next 3 weeks figuring out how this works. Oh, I want to use PowerPoint. Oh, the little go button is a tiny little icon down here. What are they doing? Right? Rearranging deck chairs, maybe? In any case, my point here, though, is that if you're going to have an open system, which I think is best, right? Apple's approach, frankly, with a closed box did not work very well. It's why they largely lost in the PC wars of the 1980s, and the IBM PC took over. Apple might have had a cooler-looking machine and a more robust or a more secure machine, but it was also viciously overpriced. People couldn't play with it. Computer scientists who wanted to explore were kept out of the box. So on the PC side, the push for standards was very, very powerful. So where do standards come from? I'm going to close on standards because we only have a few minutes left. Think of standards. Think of our televisions, at least the ones that we're going to have until February, our traditional televisions. When do you think the broadcast, the standard for American broadcast TV was written? The so-called NCSA, no, not NCSA, NTSC standard? 1920. You're close, not 1920, but 1937. RCA came out with the first TV and had it at the the New York World's Fair, which was 39. They came up with a standard in 37. That standard for television that was fixed in 1937 will have lasted into 2009. We all had cruddy television resolution for a half a century. Why? Because the NTSC standard was a standard that was using 1930s technology. I remember going to Europe, or living in Europe for the first time in the 1980s and watching European TV and realizing, wow, this is much better. Not the programming. I mean, it's the same schlock regardless. But watching European TV, it was like, hey, the picture's much clearer. Why? Because the U.S. set the TV standard in 1939. Europe set the PAL standard in the late 1940s or 1950, somewhere circa 1950. In the intervening years, the technology improved, so Europe got fixed around a better standard. Right? This happens all the time. We have to have standards to make things work. How many of us have gone overseas and done the plug dance, for example? Oh, yeah. Yeah. What a pain in the ass. I remember first time I went to South Africa, I went to an appliance store, and you'd buy appliances, and they didn't have plugs. Because you would buy your appliance and then go to the service window and buy the plug, because different power companies dictated different plugs. Is this not crazy? So we have to have standards, but if we set the standards too early, we freeze in a technology that's not particularly robust, the same way we did with televisions. If we set the standard too late, then there's a de facto standard out there already that has been determined by markets. Let me close on one very important observation. Who are the best parties to write standards? Answer, the engineers. Engineers will write standards according to what works best. Companies will write standards according to what is best for the company. A very, very important distinction. Microsoft, if left on their own, will always write a standard that works really well for Microsoft, but chances are screws everybody else. It fits with their business model. It doesn't fit for what's best in the computing ecosystem. Thanks very much. Have a good weekend. Thank you very much.